Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, April 10th, 2020. And remember when Trump told us that this thing was all going to be over by Easter? Well, let me offer somber recognition of Good Friday and the Passover, and happier greetings for Easter coming up on Sunday. I've got a lot of news to cover today. As you know, originally this podcast was intended to be about half an hour, and it has crept up as long as an hour or even a few minutes more. And as always, I advise you, you are not required to listen to it all or in one sitting or one long walk. And you can always check the show file, the rundown, which is available, linked to this podcast at peterbcollins.com, and use that fast forward button whenever you feel the need. So today we open with an interesting column, actually a pair of columns, on the opinion pages of the New York Times. And Paul Krugman is a man who I've interviewed a couple of times, Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor at Princeton, and I generally respect him. I did lose faith in him when he fell for Hillary Clinton and has continued to marginalize Bernie Sanders through the 2019-2020 campaign. But today he gets it right with a headline, "American Democracy May Be Dying." Now, we have a republic that is fading. I don't generally refer to it as a democracy, but we have these elections, which are often corrupt and misleading and manipulated in their results. And fundamentally, I want to note that we have a situation where in way too many states that are Republican-controlled, we have a rule by a majority that is, in fact, a minority. And Wisconsin has proved this once again. And we saw the partisan U.S. Supreme Court and the even more partisan Wisconsin State Supreme Court intervene to force an election when other states have wisely delayed theirs, shifted to mail-in voting exclusively. And Krugman correctly compares it to Hungary, where Viktor Orban has expanded from soft authoritarianism to a hardline dictatorship. And he got the legislative body there to give him unlimited powers, including the ability to rule by decree, and it's nominally to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. But there is no sunset, no expiration date for these dictatorship powers. And he goes from there to say, if you think that something similar can't happen here, you're hopelessly naive. In fact, it's already happening here, especially at the state level. Wisconsin in particular is well on its way toward becoming Hungary on Lake Michigan as Republicans seek a permanent lock on power. And he cites, going back to 2018, the voters chose a Democratic governor. And he is not blameless in this electoral debacle. Tony Evers, I thought, waited until the last minute, and maybe he thought that was the prudent way to ram through his executive order to delay the election. I think that would be generous, because I think that he felt that lower turnout would benefit Joe Biden over Bernie Sanders and seal the deal. And in fact, Bernie did bail out the day after the flawed election was staged in Wisconsin. But back to Krugman. In 2018, voters chose a Democratic governor, gave 53% of their support to Democratic candidates for the state assembly. But the state is so heavily gerrymandered that despite this popular vote majority, Democrats got only 36% of the assembly seats. Again, voters overwhelmingly chose a Democrat, 53%, but it yielded only 36% of the representation in the lower house. Again from Krugman, Far from trying to reach some accommodation with the governor-elect, Republicans moved to effectively emasculate him. And we remember that challenge right after the election. And Wisconsin, like most of the country, is under a stay-at-home order. So why did Republican legislators, eventually backed by the Republican appointees to the U.S. Supreme Court, insist on holding an election as if the situation were normal? The answer is that the state shutdown had a much more severe impact on voting in Democratic-leaning urban areas, where a majority of polling places were closed, than in rural or suburban areas. So the state Republican Party was nakedly exploiting a pandemic to disenfranchise those likely to vote against it. And because a partisan bloc of the Supreme Court backed its efforts, and Trump blurted out, if we expand early voting and voting by mail, you'd never have a Republican elected in this country. Their motives are nakedly clear. And almost wrapping it up here, Krugman says, this November, it's all too possible that Trump will eke out an Electoral College win thanks to widespread voter suppression. If he does, or even if he wins cleanly, right, everything we've seen suggests that he will use a second term to punish everyone he sees as a domestic enemy, and that his party will back him all the way. That is, America will do a full Hungary. And I agree. I think Krugman is, spot on about this. I haven't seen him identify these issues in this kind of way before. And I've been railing about election integrity issues since the stolen election of 2000, the stolen election of 2004, and so on. The companion column is written by African-American opinionist Jamel Bowie. And the headline reads, Trump wants 50 Wisconsin on Election Day. And he opens, the voting debacle in Wisconsin was further evidence of an incontrovertible reality in American politics. The Republican Party does not believe in free and fair elections, where free means equal access to the ballot, and fair means equitable rules and neutral procedures. Last week, once it was clear that the pandemic would make in-person voting unsafe, Governor Tony Evers, a Democrat, convened a session of the Wisconsin legislature to find a solution. The Republican majority leader gaveled the chamber in and just as quickly gaveled it out. There would be no session and thus no solution. Republicans wanted to hold the election as is, endangering the lives of voters who went to the polls in the midst of a pandemic. When on Monday, Evers issued an executive order to push the election to June and give officials time to implement universal vote by mail, it was immediately overturned by the conservative majority. I think it's 8-1. Let me guess that. And the most contentious statewide item on the ballot was an open seat. And the Republicans were trying to shove Daniel Kelly into that post. And then Bowie writes, the conservative majority of the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the state Republican Party, which had sued to stop and extend a deadline for absentee ballots. And then he explains the extreme gerrymander drawn in 2011 is the reason Wisconsin Republicans hold nearly 2/3 of the seats in the state assembly. Echoing what Professor Krugman had said. And we have the census underway right now. It's not going to be accurate because of the impact of the stay-at-home orders. The door-to-door canvassing is what brings out the full data of people who don't respond to mail, who may or may not have internet access, or may be afraid to participate. And so we can expect, with the one exception of Virginia, which has joined California and a handful of other states in adopting citizens' redistricting commissions, that the gerrymandering and the majority rule exercised by the minority Republicans will continue. And interestingly, a news analysis piece in today's New York Times challenges the notion that Trump has advanced, along with many other Republicans, that vote by mail favors Democrats. I've linked to this piece. You can read it for yourselves. But let me quote a little bit. As with false claims by Republicans about vote-by-mail fraud, there is no evidence to back up the argument from the right that all mail elections favor Democrats. Five states, Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Utah, and Washington, now have all-mail elections in which ballots are sent to every registered voter. And others, like Arizona and California, allow voters to permanently vote by mail. None of these states has seen an appreciable shift favoring Democrats that officials and experts attribute to the absentee voting. And they go into details of a study. I encourage you to take a look at that. But I found it pretty persuasive. And speaking of the good old U.S. mail, the Postal Service is getting hammered. There has been a sharp drop in mail volume. In fact, I haven't seen a postal worker here at the Secret Studio, I think, in more than 2 weeks. Not sure what's going on. Maybe they've forgotten about us here. Or maybe you've forgotten to send me anything besides bills. Anyway, this is part of a long-running effort by Republicans to kill the Postal Service in favor of FedEx and UPS. And we know the voodoo accounting that was imposed on the post office during the Bush administration, where they are required to fund every year the full retirement benefits of the entire workforce. Nobody does that. No corporation operates under those kinds of accounting rules. So right now, the Postal Service is asking for $89 billion. Based on a $13 billion revenue shortfall this fiscal year, another $54 billion in losses over the next 10 years, and just this year, $14 billion is needed to pay long-term debt related to the retirement benefits program. And the New York Times doesn't explain what I just explained to you about the long-running partisan effort to kill the post office through these bizarre accounting systems. And there are no members of Congress who want to vote by mail. But considering the risk of traveling to D.C. and operating in the House chamber with 435 members in close quarters, there's a legitimate call, which is being rebuffed by Speaker Pelosi. Nancy says, "We're not there yet. We're not going to be there, no matter how many letters somebody sends in, with all the respect in the world for that." She cited a number of concerns, including the security of any technology used, the constitutionality of changes to the rules, the logistics of having members vote on those changes, and the time needed to be sure any new system is well thought out and bipartisan. And I would add, secure. So a chorus of voices, mainly from here in the Bay Area. Eric Swalwell, who you remember briefly ran for president last year, he has introduced a series of resolutions to allow House members to vote remotely, going back to 2013. Ro Khanna from Silicon Valley renewed the call, tweeting a series of reasons why any argument against remote voting doesn't hold up to reality. My Congressman Jared Huffman, quote, "Everyone in Congress is trying to figure out how we do business functionally as a body if we're still looking at significant shelter-in-place restrictions in May." And even Zoe Lofgren, who's a veteran and a chair of the House Administration Committee, which would be the committee that would propose the changes and develop some system, she's pushing back against Pelosi. "I think it's a mistake, whether it's voting as a House or as a committee, to focus on technology rather than the principles involved. Whether it's in person or using components of technology, it's preserving elements of the democracy, the democratic system that is important." My file today on the impacts to American prisoners from the pandemic is pretty thick. First, at the Lansing Correctional Facility, that's a federal lockup in Kansas. Well, prisoners today ransacked offices, broke windows, set small fires for several hours before the facility was locked down. This followed a report that a dozen staff and a dozen inmates had tested positive for COVID-19. In Chicago, at the Cook County Jail, more than 450 inmates and staff have tested positive, and that is considered one of the nation's largest single outbreaks. One person so far has died. And at a Washington State penitentiary earlier this week, the correctional officers fired non-lethal pellets and used pepper spray to break up a riot of more than 100 inmates after six of them tested positive. And it's the Oakdale Federal Prison in Louisiana where eight prisoners have died. Oh, I see. It's eight prisoners statewide, including five at Oakdale. And a man who should have been released months ago, Raymond Rivera, who was locked up at Rikers Island, the ancient and decrepit jail, just off of New York City, off Manhattan. He was arrested on a minor parole violation. And today, I see this was 1 week ago, last Friday, state parole officials finally lifted the warrant against Rivera as he lay in a bed at the Bellevue Hospital Center, and he died the next day. And his case is, it's tragic, because he is not even among those who were supposed to be released on an expedited basis to reduce the population and try to limit transmission inside the massive Rikers Island complex. But the story is quite tragic, because Rivera, arrested last summer, his case was delayed when he had to change lawyers, not his own fault. It was a conflict of interest. And 6 weeks ago, an administrative judge decided to release him, and he should have gotten out within 5 days. But it didn't happen. He became ill, fainted in jail, sent to the prison ward at Bellevue, tested positive for the virus, and doctors discovered he also had cancer. Meanwhile, at the Metropolitan Detention Center, which is in Brooklyn, that's the federal jail, officials are transferring incarcerated people who've tested positive out of quarantine and back into general housing units with scores of other people only days after they've tested positive. And this complaint is not coming from the bleeding heart defense attorneys for those incarcerated, but from the union that represents the guards. And they've gone into court trying to get some relief. Vice President of the union, Rhonda Barnwell, why do we have two inmates who tested positive on regular housing units? And she names the units. These inmates were released to general population even before 7 days of quarantine. And why aren't those housing units on quarantine with appropriate PPE for staff? And the report is that there are 3,000, I don't know if they're N95 or surgical masks, but they're locked up in a cabinet. And another union official told The Intercept, I've been pleading with the agency to give us N95 masks. They have close to 3,000 in the institution, but they're keeping them in locked closets. And there's more. The U.S. Attorney's offices have continued to resist public defenders' efforts to win bail and compassionate release. At bail hearings, federal prosecutors have argued that vulnerable people should not be released because the Bureau of Prisons is taking the necessary measures to protect them, going so far as to argue that it's safer inside New York City's federal jails than in the outside world. That is absurd and incredibly unjust. A little sweetener here for these cases before we go to the prison in Britain where Julian Assange is at risk. Prison officials across the United States are responding to an element that was inserted in the bailout bill for Wall Street that gave a few crumbs to average citizens, the CARES Act. It authorizes free phone calls for people in federal prison and their families. Now, this is an emergency situation. As you may know, if you have a friend or relative in a federal prison, they're only able to make collect calls to you, and those are jacked up rates with kickbacks to the institutions. And activists for inmates have urged every state, county, and city to follow the lead of Congress and make calls free in state prisons and local jails. Now to Julian Assange at the Max Security Belmarsh Prison outside London. And we get coverage from Craig Murray. I've linked to his blog if you'd like to read all the details in his latest post. But we've heard before from Joe Lauria when I interviewed him about the preliminary hearings for the Assange extradition to the United States. By the way, the judge, Magistrate Vanessa Beretzer, she has refused a delay in the process, even though Assange is not able to talk to his lawyers or work on his defense. So, one of the ugliest things that Vanessa Beretzer has done, and by the way, she has maintained almost the lowest profile possible. If you Google her name, there are very few entries, and they're all just in news accounts about the Assange trial. They have scrubbed any photos of her on the internet. But we learn, I did not know this, Julian Assange has a partner and young children who are living in London. And this became an issue before the court because in a bail application, Assange said, well, look, I've got some place to go. My partner and our kids are right here in London. But Beretzer summarily dismissed the application for bail and then went on to order that the identity, at least of the partner, and perhaps including the children, is now public information. And Craig Murray has retaliated. If you go to his blog, you will find that he's posted a video that somebody dug up of the magistrate Vanessa Beretzer performing some song and dance number in a high school or school musical of some sort. But the attorney representing Assange, Mark Summers, he's a British, I guess that would make him a solicitor. I can't recall exactly the terms they use there. Anyway, he trembled with anger. He appealed it immediately, asking for a 14-day stay, and Beretzer granted 4. And Murray asserts that based on 3 witnesses who were there, they're unanimous that yet again, Beretzer entered the court carrying pre-written judgments before hearing oral argument, pre-written judgments she gave no appearance of modifying. And over 150 prison staff at Belmarsh are off work self-isolating. They describe the disease ripping through the jail like wildfire, and that Julian, who is locked up 23 and a half hours a day, has 30 minutes of exercise in an enclosure with many other prisoners. And that Assange is vulnerable with a cough and chronic lung condition, which is well known, and he's been treated for it for years. And so the massive cruelty that is wielded against those who are in custody. And keep in mind that Assange he has been charged with no violent acts. He's published stuff that governments didn't want public. That does not make him a risk to the community, and certainly bail can be structured to keep him from fleeing. And over at Consortium News, they published an unsigned update that Julian has told a friend in a phone conversation that he's living in a prison where the virus is ripping through the population, and that he did not show up for a video link to his case management hearing this past Tuesday because he is unwell. But they underscore that so far it is not diagnosed as COVID-19. And here is our daily update on the coronavirus prepared by Linda Lewis. Worldwide, we have 1.67 million confirmed cases, 101,526 deaths. Here in the United States, the death count has just rolled past 18,000, and there are 486,000, so call it 500,000 confirmed cases. And we're going to delve in a little bit to the collection of the data and arguments that it's both underreported and that cases that are not directly caused by the coronavirus are just kind of mindlessly added to the tally. We'll get to that shortly. But Linda focuses today on supply disruptions and, in particular, the food chain. She cites a New York Times report across North America, Europe, and elsewhere. Factories are idled. Workers are in lockdown. At some ports, goods are piling up. In other places, container ships sail empty. Dairy farmers are dumping their milk. Grocery store shelves have been picked bare. And in particular, when it comes to food, food processing monopolies, complicated logistics, federal red tape, inadequate worker protections, and border restrictions have been cited for a huge disconnect between food production and consumer needs. As U.S. food banks handle record demand and grocery stores struggle to keep shelves stocked, the article says, farmers are dumping fresh milk, plowing vegetables back into the dirt, as the shutdown of food service industry has scrambled the supply chain. Thousands of acres of fruits and vegetables grown in Florida are being plowed under or left to rot because farmers can't sell to restaurants, theme parks, or schools nationwide. Other states are having the same issues. Leafy greens in California. There's a shortage of labor to go into the fields and pick the produce. Dairy farmers in Vermont and Wisconsin say they've had to dump a surplus of milk intended for restaurants. Many growers have donated produce to food banks, but there's a limit on what charities can accept, and storage is an issue. Here in, right here in Marin County, a wealthy area in California where I'm based, I share my studio with a Latino nonprofit, the Multicultural Center of Marin. They have long been operating a weekly food program, and the number of people who've been accessing it has shot up from an average of 150 families per week to over 400. And other food banks are being similarly impacted. San Antonio, Texas, 6,000 families lined up in cars for hours for their portion of 1 million pounds of food distributed. Sunrise, Florida, cars backed up bumper to bumper, 600% increase in demand. Duquesne, Pennsylvania, a mile-long line of motorists waited for food from the Pittsburgh Food Bank. Police set up toilets, portable toilets, about every third of a mile to handle the large crowds who showed up. Salem, Virginia, demand has exploded during the emergency, but key sources of food supply have faltered. The CEO of Feeding America said the people we serve in the charitable food system in the U.S. are facing a perfect storm, with surges in demand, declines in food donations and volunteers, and disruptions to normal operating procedures. And two interjections here. In Italy, police are very concerned because various arms of La Cosa Nostra, the mafia, are stepping in where the government has failed. They are running their own food delivery and giveaway programs, particularly in the poorest quarters of cities like Naples. And here I want to continue my pause to recognize a significant donor to the newly launched Peter B. Collins Podcast Community Fund. Joe Carson has been a longtime supporter of this podcast. He is a frequent correspondent with a lot of good information and commentary. He is based in Knoxville, Tennessee. He is a surviving whistleblower who works for the Department of Energy, and he is a Christian. And while I have become agnostic, I was raised a Catholic. I embrace much of the message of Jesus Christ. I just don't care much for the earthly institution that is purported to represent him. But Joe sent me a note, thanks for the opportunity to be a blessing via your fund to others. And he contributed $250 yesterday. And Joe, I'm very grateful for that. He says, my Christian worldview evolves. Brian McLaren's work has been influential, but I read about 200 books a year, so I'm eclectic. He refers to a Sunday school teacher, a New Testament scholar. And he says, you can disagree, but I put some fault for the scope of this pandemic and how unprepared America was at the feet of Christian religious professionals. Are any of them now saying anything as, why didn't concerned public health officials and medical professionals come to us with their concerns? We could have joined their voices and maybe have changed things. Then he says, good luck with that in trying to find one. Which, referring to me, he says, is possibly a reason that I put Christianity in my rearview mirror decades ago. And he adds that they're going to have a virtual Easter egg hunt with a son and partner in Denver and a daughter and a partner in Atlanta. And a third son will be there in Knoxville. So I don't have any applications today for a $100 grant from our community fund. So let me restate for people who might not have heard about it. I decided to set this up, and I'm contributing my $1,200 loan from the government whenever it shows up. I'm floating it in the meantime. And for the next 60 days, all subscription income to the Peter B. Collins podcast is going to go into the community fund. If you're not a subscriber, give what you can. We will acknowledge your contributions unless you ask to be anonymous. We're going to give out grants of $100, one per household. We will be liberal, but we do request that you state the purpose of the money you're seeking and allow us to judge if, that's reasonable. If it's rent or groceries, just say that. Tell us what your total need is, and we'll chip in $100. And perhaps listeners will contact me and say, hey, I'd like to help that family out with a direct contribution. Anything will work, and we're going to be very flexible here. I also want to mention that if you live outside the United States, you still qualify. The hardship is not limited to our borders or the English language. So if you want to make a contribution, use PayPal, link to Peter at peterbcollins.com, that email. And if you're allergic to PayPal, yo comprendo, you can mail in a letter contribution or an application, a request for a grant. My P.O. Box is number 150660, San Rafael, California, 94915. So back to Linda's summary for today. We have 2.5 million farm workers, most of whom are Latinx, working in the fields. A growing number of foreign guest workers, most from Mexico, are brought to the U.S. every year under the H-2A visa program. And they are operating without protective gear, without access generally to medical care. And they break their backs to bring us the food that we rely on at this difficult time. Then Linda shifts to global supply wars. At least 69 countries now have banned or restricted the export of protective equipment, medical devices, or medicines. And while much of that is understandable, I would argue that much of it is because the U.S. has been greedy, grabby, and thuggish in throwing our money and our weight around. And I continue to cite the heist at the Bangkok airport of a plane load of PPE that was paid for and bound for Germany. And we stole it. We don't know who the operatives were, whether they were corporate goons or part of our intelligence apparatus, but that is a fact. Also, in New York City, an additional 777 people, as part of the official death count, added to a total now that reaches 7,844. And Cuomo today said, before there is talk of reopening, millions of tests to diagnose people and tests for antibodies are needed. The New York labs are working on these tests but couldn't produce nearly what is needed. And thus, whatever the return to work date is, it is not in sight right now. And in Michigan, let me add that I've spent a lot of time in Michigan. My ex-wife's family had a lakeside home near Petoskey. I spent many summers there, and my partner Kathy is from Michigan, and I've been there dozens of times over the last 30 years. And one of the fruits of the expansion of the middle class that was led by unionized auto workers is that a family could afford a home in Detroit or a suburb, and also a little cabin on a lake somewhere upstate in Michigan, including the UP, the Upper Peninsula. And so the governor, Gretchen Whitmer, has instructed people that they may not travel to a second home. And I know some people bristle at that, but I think it is a reasonable restriction because it will limit the spread. And look at these jokers, all right? A group of would-be vacationers flew in a private jet from London to Marseille, where they had three helicopters waiting for them on the ground to fly them to a rented luxury villa somewhere near Cannes. Now, I've spent time in that area. It's beautiful. And let me hasten to add that the news account I have is that none of the people involved were actually from Britain. They appeared to have gathered there, and let's see, some were from Croatia, Germany, France, Romania, Ukraine. And the French officials would not admit them to the country, and they tried to pull some strings, stayed about 4 hours trying to get somebody to authorize it, and then they retreated to London. A chilling development here that is described as an effort to help track people who may have been in contact with other people who are tested, who have tested positive with the coronavirus. And you've heard the term contact tracing. And it is chilling that our iPhones will spy on us and not only tell people our location, maybe tell us whether we're properly maintaining safe distances from other iPhones and the people whose pockets they're in. But this can be justified to some extent as a way to gather data. But the GPS in your phone and the information that can be picked up from it, they're assuring us it'll all be kept private. But like Viktor Orban's dictatorial powers and ruling by decree in Hungary, is there a sunset? Is there an end date to this intrusive collection of information? And while I'm one of those people who can say, I don't have a girlfriend on the side, I don't have a secret to protect based on my location at any moment, but I still don't want that information collected. It's my privacy. And too many people say, oh, I've got nothing to hide. Go ahead. It's for the greater good. The Fourth Amendment has been shredded so badly, and people have learned helplessness to the point that I may be the only voice you hear screaming in opposition to this proposal. And get this, over Easter weekend, in the southwestern corner of Deutschland, on the banks of Lake Constance, the local officials are deploying a Zeppelin. Yeah. A hot air, well, a dirigible. It's not a hot air balloon, you know, with a rainbow of colors. It's like a Goodyear blimp. And there'll be six cops riding in the Zeppelin, in radio contact with colleagues on the ground. And when they spot any large groups, the ground forces will be dispatched to break them up. And there are threats of citations for people here in California who violate the stay-away orders, the closures of state parks, particularly along the beaches. And I understand that a lot of people flouted the advisories not to do that when we had some balmy weather a couple of weekends ago. But I shiver at the loss of our rights. And in Baltimore, aerial surveillance from planes that fly over the city all day long are being challenged in court, and I fully support this litigation. Now, we've covered this before. It was a rich guy from Texas who used a foundation to fund the initial overflights of Baltimore and the collection of information. Now, you can argue, and they do, that it has one of the highest per capita murder rates in the country. There were 348 people killed in 2019, the most in 25 years, and more than New York City total, not per capita, which has 13 times the population. And basically, they would put a layer of surveillance, and they tell us, oh, we're only going to look at the videos if a crime is committed. Yeah, right. Over at Who, What, Why, my colleague Jeff Scheckman has put up a podcast that looks intriguing. I haven't had a chance to listen. But he talks to Chuck Collins, a guy who made a lot of money and has given most of it away. And Chuck Collins runs an operation out of Boston that urges the government to tax the wealthy. And if I'm correct, and I think I am, Bill Gates Sr. is or was involved with Chuck Collins' advocacy group. And in the podcast, Jeff Scheckman discusses with Collins the role of billionaires and notes in the blurb here that Jeff Bezos has given $100 million to food banks. And that's equivalent, the equivalent of somebody with 20 grand in the bank donating $20. Oh, boy. Now I want to get into some discussion of issues that I think you should consider. In an enterprise story in today's San Francisco Chronicle, it opens this way. As California and other states stockpile ventilators to prepare for a surge of coronavirus patients, a debate is emerging among doctors across the country about whether the breathing machines actually hinder recovery from COVID-19. Now, there are a lot of variables here, but there is some early data. In Wuhan, China, they examined the cases of 37 critically ill patients who were put on ventilators, and 30 died within a month. Now, was it the ventilator, or was it being critically ill? In England and Northern Ireland, 67% have died after receiving advanced respiratory support, which includes ventilators. Early data from New York City, according to the Associated Press, 80% of coronavirus patients placed on ventilators have died. Again, I can't parse this to determine cause and effect, whether this is what we call correlational as opposed to evidentiary. But here in the Bay Area, some doctors are wondering whether using a ventilator might be worse for some patients, or at least whether they should delay the intervention. But one of the issues is when you put somebody on a ventilator, you have to sedate them to get that tube down their throats. And a long time ago, I was in a car accident, and they wanted to insert a stomach pump with a tube that went up my nose and down my throat, and God knows how it got to my stomach. I guess I'm a little weak on some anatomy. But the first time they shoved that thing up my nose and down my throat, I pulled it out. It was too painful and too intrusive. They strapped me down, added more lube, and I allowed it the second time. And the other issue that I'm raising again as no kind of medical expert is that if your body becomes accustomed to having your breathing done for it by a machine, at some point do you lose the facility to breathe on your own? It's a question, and I don't have the answer. Now, I also want to dive in to some challenges to the data that have been collected on fatalities from coronavirus. And I touched on this yesterday, that it's being advanced by Rush Limbaugh and others as a talking point to minimize the impact of the pandemic. And I also allowed that the definition of what is a COVID-19 death is not consistent and may vary widely from one jurisdiction to the next. So I have comments from the northern extremes of the United States on both coasts. First, from Dick Atlee in Maine. And he is a vaccine safety advocate who has given me a lot of good information over the years. And he wrote back to the Center on National Security at Fordham, which publishes data on a daily basis. And he raised questions in his thorough but non-confrontational way. And he looked up the FAQs, the Frequently Asked Questions, at Fordham. Question: what happens if the terms reported on the death certificate indicate uncertainty? If the death certificate reports terms such as probable COVID-19 or likely COVID-19, these terms would be assigned the new ICD code, and it's not likely that the National Center for Health Statistics will follow up on these cases. Next question: should COVID-19 be reported on the death certificate only with a confirmed test? And here's where it gets really wobbly. Answer: COVID-19 should be reported on the death certificate for all decedents where the disease caused or is assumed to have caused or contributed to death. And he notes the last part there is all bolded and that that's in the original. The answer continues: certifiers should include as much detail as possible based on their knowledge of the case. If the decedent had other chronic conditions like COPD or asthma that may have contributed, they can be reported in part two. So this is a very serious issue related to the collection of data. And as I've said, I don't personally have great confidence in the data coming from China, which is the baseline for many of the studies and projections that we've seen. And Dick notes the Italian health agency has gone out of its way to point out that their death statistics cover dying with the virus rather than dying from it. So from Washington State, I believe that Paul Leto is in the Kirkland area, and he's been in touch with me frequently. He's a man I respect, and he wrote me last night, related to my comments yesterday. He said, right-wing toadies are not entirely out of line when you read the definitions of what a COVID-19 death is. And he basically cites what we just heard from Dick Atlee. So he says, COVID-19 is real, but death rates are highly inflated, both from under-testing and from false positives dying for independent reasons. So I replied, in my podcast today, I allowed as much depending on definitions. But Trumpers want to confuse people in an effort to minimize the death count, even as healthy younger people without underlying conditions who went to Mardi Gras or mega churches are dying. On balance, the underreporting due to lack of testing and people who aren't hospitalized and die from the symptoms aren't being counted. They offset the factors that you cite. I think the mitigation efforts are working, and the arguments over data are mostly political. Well, I'm revising that based on the information from Paul and from Dick Atlee. And so Paul responded, National Vital Statistics is in the federal government, so it's at least quite odd that the Trump-controlled federal government is pushing such a broad definition of COVID death. The one place people are getting tested is hospitals, 60% or more of all deaths occur in a hospital or in transit. I don't think the dying are under-tested, even if others are under-tested. With respect, he says, the notion that the broad definition is offset by under-testing is a possibility, but not one supported by any data I'm aware of. And then he says, I would place the burden of proof on your side on this one, if only because the higher the death tolls go, the more we have to pay in freedoms and money for this last and most epic instance of shock doctrine. Now, I share your concerns about how opportunists are using this pandemic for all kinds of nefarious purposes. But let me add a column. This is a statistical piece from the New York Times today. And they talk about these wobbly figures and the number of people who are dying at home and not being properly or accurately recorded as a COVID-19 death. It opens. In the first 5 days of April, 1,125 people were pronounced dead in their homes or on the street in New York City, more than eight times the deaths recorded during the same period in 2019. Many of these deaths were probably caused by COVID-19, but were not accounted for in the tallies given by Governor Cuomo during his widely watched daily news conference. On Thursday, Cuomo said almost 800 people in New York had died in a single 24-hour period, and more than 33 an hour. But epidemiologists, city officials, and medical personnel say those numbers are likely to be far below the city's actual death toll. So Cuomo said on Wednesday the official count presented each day are based on hospital data. And the city has a different measure. Any patient who has had a positive coronavirus test and then later dies, whether at home or in a hospital, is being counted as a coronavirus death. And the commissioner of health in New York says, to date, we have only been recording on people who have had the test. But then they talk about the uncounted. A staggering number of people are dying at home with presumed cases of coronavirus, and it doesn't appear that the state has a clear mechanism for factoring them into the official tallies. Paramedics are not performing coronavirus tests on those they pronounce dead. It's almost impossible to say how many of those 1,125 patients who died at home or on the street in the first 5 days of April had coronavirus. Later, they say, there aren't really any mechanisms in place for having an immediate, efficient method to calculate the death toll. For example, when someone died at home 6 months ago, the paramedics would pronounce the person dead on scene, take them to a hospital where doctors would pronounce them dead, then they'd certify the death and issue a cause. Then the body would be taken to a funeral home or a morgue if an autopsy was indicated. But during this pandemic, these procedures are inconsistent at best. Doctors are struggling to certify deaths quickly enough. Paramedics are not transporting unresponsive patients to hospitals. Bodies are piling up in morgues and freezer trucks. And so I have to say that it's very difficult to get a clear picture at this point. And I respect the questions raised by Dick and Paul. Thank you both. Bernie Sanders and a colleague from Washington State, Republican Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, have introduced the Healthcare Emergency Guarantee Act, which would empower Medicare to pay for all costs of treatment for the uninsured, cover all out-of-pocket costs for those with public or private insurance, for as long as this pandemic continues. And Sanders said, during this unprecedented crisis, no one in America should delay seeking medical care because of the cost. If this pandemic has taught us anything, it is that we are only as safe as the least insured among us. Now, I don't think this is going anywhere. I wish it could. Everybody is afraid, even, corporate Democrats in the House and the Senate. It's almost impossible to get something like this through. But it is indeed a worthy proposal. Joe Biden has tipped his hat toward Sanders supporters. He's not embracing any single policy in full, But he is now saying that he will embrace expansion of Medicare to people at age 60. It's currently 65. He also promises to forgive student debt for lower-income Americans who attended public colleges and some other educational institutions. Biden said in a statement, Senator Sanders and his supporters can take pride in their work in laying the groundwork for these ideas. I'm proud to adopt them as part of my campaign at this critical moment in responding to the coronavirus crisis. Well, Joe, you know, politically, I do appreciate that you're not just ignoring the progressive left the way Hillary Clinton did in 2016. But this is just, it's not half a loaf. It's the ends of the loaf of the bread. And I don't find it sufficient. Recommended reading, Matthew Walther, writing at The Week. Headline, Biden is the weakest major party nominee in recent history, but that might be the point. And he has a lot of good arguments in here about the weaknesses of Joe Biden. Quote, I do not think it is even a slight exaggeration to say that Biden is the weakest nominee fielded by a major party in the modern history of this country. Never mind the fact that Trump's approval ratings, which at the beginning of the current pandemic were higher than Obama's at a comparable point in his first term, remain solid, and that recent polls show a steady plurality of Americans supporting his response to the pandemic. He is an incumbent, one who enjoys all the built-in advantages in addition to the unexpected one of being president and having all that free TV time. He references the allegations of Tara Reid, sexual misconduct, and goes on to cite his unacceptable record on foreign policy, race, health, his cognitive decline. I think it's a good read. Check it out. And then over at Politico, Ryan Lizza pulls back the sleeve and exposes the so-called hidden hand of Barack Obama in the Democratic primary mess this past year. And Lizza cites that there were several phone conversations between Sanders and Obama before Bernie pulled the plug, and that that is a trend. That Obama talked to Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and all of them have denied that they were influenced by anybody else in pulling out of the race. But it appears that except for Mike Bloomberg, that Obama was in touch and presumably using his gentle hidden hand to yank them out of the race. So I think it's a very interesting piece. I've long suspected this. And Lizza writes, I would say that Obama was very careful not to be seen as putting a thumb on the scale. But I think it's pretty clear. So take this from the source, all right? New York Post, right-wing rag, owned by Murdoch, publishing a poll that is a bit dubious. And before I read you the gist of it, I believe that this is an effort just to divide Democrats and weaken the already weakened Joe Biden. Anyway, a national poll found 56% of Democrats prefer Andrew Cuomo, with 44% wanting to stick with the presumptive nominee Biden. That is a 12-point margin, and the margin of error is just under 5%. The poll was conducted April 3rd to 6th. Online sample of 1,000 people using a Republican polling firm. So I hear from many of my listeners and friends. They're looking for what the Greeks called in their theater, their dramas, a deus ex machina. This outside force that intervenes and miraculously changes the whole arc of the drama. And I have to admit that I lack so much confidence in Joe Biden that it's tempting to embrace. But it upends the whole primary process, even as it was manipulated by the DNC. And If they substitute anybody, it should be the guy in second place, Bernie Sanders. But people are saying, ah, you know, he's finished. We can't go back. And even some people, in fact, Ian Berman, our correspondent in New York City, is looking for, you know, some kind of miracle outcome. And he doesn't support Andrew Cuomo because he knows too much about Cuomo. And he is suggesting maybe California Governor Gavin Newsom. Well, I know Gavin. I like him. Have a few differences. Think he's handled this overall pretty well. He's young. He's attractive. He's articulate. He's dyslexic and doesn't show it. He was the guy who took the bold steps to legalize gay marriage in San Francisco. He doesn't smoke weed, but he led the commission that legalized marijuana for adult use in California. There's a lot to like in Gavin Newsom. But I still resist. I guess I'm too idealistic about what's left of democracy, even after I opened the podcast with the arguments of its near death, that it's hard for me to get to that point of saying, oh yeah, just go to a back room, tell Joe he's done, and substitute Gavin Newsom. So another poll shows that Americans are losing faith in Trump's handling of the coronavirus crisis. Only 43% of people 65 and older say they thought Trump was doing all he could to confront the outbreak. Americans aged 50 to 64, who tend to see Trump more favorably overall, were more likely to say he was doing what he could. So keep in mind, this is a snapshot of a certain subset of voters. I don't think the overall poll numbers... Well, here's one that's broader than that. 57% of voters rate the government's response as bad. Poor is the word they use. 39% gave positive remarks. But in this poll, the real surprise, the Internal Revenue Service was seen favorably by 65% of respondents. A new record. Now, that is mixing up a couple of polls, I want to be fair. And, you know, polls are only polls. But Trump loves polls. He loves his TV ratings, and he loves standing up there and attacking people as he claims to unify us in this time of crisis as a wartime president. And even his own Republican buddies are getting nervous. Lindsey Graham says Trump sometimes drowns out his own message. Republican Congresswoman Susan Brooks, Indiana. The briefings, they're going on too long. And we last week quoted Shelley Moore Capito, the senator from West Virginia, Republican, said the briefings were going off the rails a little bit. And let's see what else is in this article. Republican lawmakers, members of his reelection campaign, said they wanted Trump to limit his error-filled appearances at the West Wing briefings and move more aggressively to prepare for the looming recession. And he held his briefing early today, I guess, in honor of Good Friday, and maybe he's going somewhere for the weekend, I don't know. But The Guardian covered it, and they identified at least five flat-out misstatements by Trump, which is a little lower than average, from what I can tell. Oh, and the Trump campaign put out a new attack ad against Sleepy Joe, as they call him, using footage from the visit in 2013 when the vice president went to Beijing for a warm welcome from the government there, and he brought Hunter Biden along with him. And I've never seen any evidence that the deals that Hunter tried to strike when he traveled, on his daddy's coattails ever turned into anything that made money for him. But Trump is sticking to that. And along the way, they use a form of a subliminal attack where they include a picture of Gary Locke, the former Democratic governor of Washington, who is Chinese-American. And it is suggested that that is being used to kind of trigger a subliminal response from the MAGA followers. Couple more stories here. Bill Barr, who plays Attorney General in this tragedy, he is facing allegations that his Justice Department, just last year, made material errors in at least two applications for wiretaps or other surveillance at the Star Chamber Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And they have had to file with the court a little mea culpa, saying, oh, no, we didn't mean to do it, you know, and we're going to fix it. And, of course, this puts into a wider context how Trump was so aggrieved with the FISA court, but only limited to the case of his volunteer advisor, Carter Page. And I've long argued that this court is lied to frequently. The judges have admitted it. And yet, the Democrats never approach the topic, and Republicans only use it for partisan purposes. And finally, we're getting more because Laura Ingraham over at the Fox News Channel played segments of her interview with Attorney General Barr on two consecutive nights. And last night, he commented on Trump's firing in the middle of last Friday night, Saturday morning, of the Inspector General, Michael Atkinson, of the intelligence community. And he was bounced for disloyalty to Trump because I believe he did his job. I'm still, you know, wobbly about the origins of the Ukraine Gate story, which came from a whistleblower who people know who it is, but we pretend we don't. And Barr said dismissing Atkinson was the right thing to do because he had overstepped his fairly narrow statute and tried to turn the whistleblower complaint into a commission to explore anything in the government. Now, that's just pure bullshit. Because it appears to me that Atkinson was very careful, knew that his head would be on the block, and went ahead and went through the proper channels to notify Congress of wrongdoing by the president. And fatuously, Barr argues that, well, Atkinson didn't let the executive branch look at it and determine whether there was any problem. Now, I think that's a flat-out lie because we understood that it was reviewed by the Justice Department and they declined to take any action before Atkinson formally reported it to Adam Schiff and the House Intelligence Committee. And even a couple of Republicans, led by Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa, have asked Trump to provide a detailed written explanation for his decision to remove Atkinson. And the letter, which was signed by other senators, they're not named here, included this statement: Congress intended that inspectors general only be removed when there is clear evidence of wrongdoing or failure to perform the duties of the office. Losing confidence without further explanation is not sufficient. Hey, thanks for joining me for today's extended news and comment podcast. Hope you have a great weekend and celebrate the Jewish and Christian holidays as you will. I'll be back at you Monday right here. You'll find this podcast on YouTube. You're invited to share it all over the place. Please contribute if you can to our relief fund. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you.